your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left, rich and a farm red. A father's son left a candy on, blue denim had his vein. Class.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, ricksmithshow.com. So, February 26th, just around the corner, the U.S. Supreme Court's going to hear the Janus versus AFSCME case, which, you know, as we've been saying on the program for, you know, the last 2 years, since the Friedrichs case was front and center, this kind of decision that I think everyone is expecting is going to be horribly disruptive. It's going to harm the working class of this country. It's going to create an environment with lower wages, worse working conditions, fewer benefits, and more corporate rule and control. Something I think the average everyday person wants no part of. But our Supreme Court, it's feared, going to be the ones who make this choice. Here to talk a little bit about, you know, what the decision, what this case is, what the potential outcome could be, and what it means for Pennsylvania's university and faculty folks. I've asked Ken Mash to come talk with us. He's the president of APSCUF. Ken, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be here, Rick. Thanks.
So I think everyone's in the same frame of mind that the Supreme Court's going to just hear this case. It's already decided. It's going to be a 5-4 decision.
Yeah, I think that's what everybody presumed since Neil Gorsuch was appointed to the court, that it was going to come down that way. But I have to say that, every public sector union that I know of has been preparing for this for a couple of years.
So in this preparation, you're talking about internal organizing, you know, making your members aware and all that, right?
Yeah, exactly. We've had the sense that we couldn't, you know, sit still and just wait for it to happen. So yeah, we've all undergone internal organizing, looked at our organizations as well, and we're preparing to come out forcefully, regardless of what the results are in the case.
Now the arguments there are arguments on both sides. You've got the union saying, look, we can't have a free rider situation of people who are going to be able to get our services and not pay for them, because understand, the current law is and has been for, you know, some 40 years, that you don't have to become a member of the union, but you do have to pay for the representation of negotiating and enforcing the contract, which to me seems perfectly logical and reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like paying for a service. So actually, most people don't even realize that in Pennsylvania, at least, the public sector unions have a duty to represent every member of the bargaining unit, whether or not they're full members of their unions. So in essence, after this decision, the public sector unions would be required to represent these people, but receive no compensation for doing so.
Now, that's not just here in Pennsylvania. That's across the country, right? Because that's federal law.
Well, it depends on, you know, the individual writings of the states of what that duty is specifically, but it's common for that to be the case. So, you know, it does, as you said, create this free rider problem where, in fact, the unions have to do all the work, and people may choose not to be a member at all or pay any dues, but yet they receive all the benefits of the union.
Yeah, I've tried that with a couple of different organizations. Hey, I'd like to have your services. Hey, I'd like to, you know, enjoy benefits of what your members get, but I don't want to pay for it. And they've all universally told me no.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is something that's commonly understood among economists, political scientists alike, that you wind up with this free rider problem. That's often why associations and the rest will provide benefits for you people to join and the rest. But we're talking about labor unions. We're talking about expensive operations to run. So it's, you know, it really is a setback for unions. But I think it's not just a setback for unions. As you alluded to when you were introducing this, this is a setback for everybody that's a working person in our Commonwealth and around the United States, because, you know, when unions get involved and they negotiate contracts, they're setting the standard in the market for salaries. and they can do so with collective action, with some power. You remove that power or you weaken that power, and what you're going to wind up with is lower wages for those in the union, which, again, becomes the marker for everybody in the workforce. So in the end, I think everyone's going to suffer should this come to pass if the unions are not able to fight back and still maintain, which is why we're trying so hard to do so.
Right. Now, the other side of the argument, the Janus folks are arguing, and in all of the other cases that have been lumped into this, that it's about freedom. It's about my freedom, Ken. If I don't want to pay you and I don't want to be a member, it's my freedom to not. Which seems to me to be kind of a flawed argument from the start, because if we take this argument to the next step, I pay every day for stuff that I don't want. I pay taxes. My government spends it on war, on, you know, Trump going to Mar-a-Lago. There's a bunch of my dollars that flow right out of my pocket and into the federal government that gets spent in a way that I don't want. This seems to be a failed argument.
Right. Well, that's, you know, the legal argument is a free speech argument. What the plaintiffs here have argued is it violates their free speech to even have to be a member of the union. So, you know, in the previous case last year in Friedrichs, one of the petitioners there actually wrote a piece in which they said the act of collective bargaining is itself a political act. So I don't want to fight for higher wages for myself and my colleagues. So I shouldn't be forced to be a member of this union. That kind of argument, you know, is specious. It's actually, and I don't want to get too complicated in here, but it's really part of an overall abuse of the understanding of what the First Amendment is. But you're correct. I mean, as a public employee, you know, in the state system of higher education, the state system contracts with Highmark, you know, which is a Blue Cross. If I don't agree with the political message of Blue Cross, I mean, do I have a right to say, give me my money back because of that? Or is it just a matter of the terms of employment? So it's really kind of a stretch in the First Amendment argument. People certainly maintain their rights to speak out against the union. They maintain their right not to be a full member, but to only pay the fair share for the services that they're receiving. So, I mean, this is really a stretched out argument, but we've seen a lot of that lately with this court.
Yeah, and your position on the Highmark thing is always interesting to me, because I have people who tell me, well, as a shareholder in the union, I should be able to abstain because of their political speech. And I go, well, you know, the weird thing is, as a shareholder in any company in this country, you don't have the right to know the company's political speech. You don't know where they're spending that money. So you don't even have that right as a corporate shareholder. So it's kind of a ridiculous argument to be making the corporate argument about labor unions.
Right. I mean, you can make that argument for so many different things. I mean, how many companies does the state government itself contract with? And I'm willing to bet, Rick, that you wouldn't agree with many of those companies' policies, but you can't withdraw and say, well, that portion of my tax dollars should come back to me that you're spending on that because I don't agree with their speech. I think this is really going to open up a hornet's nest, where you could wind up with lots of different lawsuits based on what happens with this particular case.
Which is why I think, Ken, we've seen an awful lot of libertarian think tanks throwing their name into this. Because at the end of it, their goal is not simply to take down unions, although that's a great benefit for them. It's about tearing down the federal government and creating this avenue where they think exactly what you just said. They're going to be able to go and say, well, we don't agree with this or that or any federal spending. And now you've codified it in law.
Yeah, these groups are not shy about what they believe. They're pretty out there and outspoken. What their funders tend to be a little shy about wanting it out there, about the fact that they're giving money to these causes. But, yeah, I think that this is really a case that, when it's decided, could be awful precedent for lots of different things for people who care about government and want government to actually make people's lives better.
Yeah, now, to me, I think we're at one of those moments, and I'm watching with great interest to see what the labor movement does in response to this, because, you know, we've had these moments throughout our history where bad things have happened, and, you know, the reaction, you know, either hasn't been up to, you know, to the task or what? And I'm kind of interested to see where this goes.
Yeah, I think that you'll get a good sense of that beginning on Saturday when, you know, when we have these working people's days of action. We have a big event that's going to take place in Philadelphia and around the Commonwealth, too, where I'm expecting to see large groups of people out in advance of Janus to say that, you know, you are threatening working people across the country, and we just don't want to, you know, that just can't happen.
Now, the other side of this, and you know, what I tell most of my friends who really don't know much about it and are in favor of it, because, hey, it sounds right, is that this isn't really about even the workers or the union workers at all. This has everything to do with just destroying an institution that levels greed and wants to work to close the inequality gap. And also, it's Machiavellian politics. This is the Republicans trying to, well, gut the Democratic Party, because Democrats have gotten a good portion of their money from the labor movement. Because, look, the Republicans have been out to try and destroy the labor movement, so there's really nowhere else to go. And this is just, it's not about workers. It's not about we the people. It's about just Machiavellian politics.
Yeah, well, it's about money, first and foremost. I mean, you've got a group of people who are millionaires and billionaires who are funding this operation to try and get to government to reduce it, because, you know, they just don't like the regulations. They don't like having to treat people fairly. They don't like the fact that unions are a countervailing force against all those things that are wrapped up in the profit motive. So, you know, you are right that they've undertaken this strategy, but it's only one strategy and a larger overarching strategy to weaken government in the first place. In a book that I wrote with a colleague, you know, we talked about the fact that, you know, when you look at workers are really a resource pool, but when you look at the way the economy runs, it's always in the interest of people who are involved in business and companies to exploit common resources. You know, it's what we call the tragedy of the commons problem, right? Where it's, you know, you could, if there was a common area of grass and everybody had cows all around, and they all understood that by allowing their folks to graze there, that, you know, they could, in fact, if everybody did it all once and all at one time, it would ruin the resource itself, and that there would be no grass ultimately there. So, you know, you would say, well, okay, well, it makes sense to come up with a rule to break that up, but ultimately there's going to be someone who exploits the rules and breaks it up, and that's why we have government to step in. Well, when it comes to labor, the incentive is for companies to exploit the labor force, that is, to get the most out of people as far as work and pay them the absolute least. And unless government steps up to set up regulations, minimum wage, if it's not going to be the government, unless you have labor unions to come in and say, we're not going to accept that, ultimately the incentive is to underpay people, which ultimately, by the way, is destructive of the entire system.
Yeah, which is why we've seen stagnant wages for the last 30, 40 years as the labor movement, as labor density has declined. And, you know, again, why I would argue that here recently, all we've seen are bonuses being handed out and not actual wages, not wage increases through this tax increase. Lots of work to do. I wanted to change the topic a little bit.
Sure.
You know, here in Pennsylvania, the state Supreme Court finally came out with their map. The Republicans drew up their second clown map. It was rejected by the governor. The state Supreme Court has come out with their map. I'm curious your thoughts on it.
Well, you know, as far as the map goes, you know, but just eyeballing the map, the districts look like normal districts as opposed to the maps that were submitted before with their squiggly lines and running through, you know, various different places and curvatures that made it look like some sort of obscene jigsaw puzzle. Well, ultimately, the Supreme Court of the United States refused to hear the case that was brought by the legislature, and that's not shocking because, you know, ultimately the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania has the right to interpret Pennsylvania law. And I think that ultimately what we're going to see is a similar thing, that the Supreme Court is going to say back to these challenges that it is up to the interpretation of the Pennsylvania court. Now, when we talk about actually drawing the map, that comes down to what we call with courts remedial power, that is their power to make up for mistakes. So since the court gave the legislature and the governor the opportunity to fix and correct what they found to be a violation, if they don't do that, then the court has really strong powers and always has to come in and make those changes. And of course, if the legislature doesn't like it, you know, when time goes by, they can pass another law and redraw those districts. So I'm expecting to see that we're going to proceed ahead with those districts that were drawn by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court.
Yeah, but, you know, here's the thing. I thought the same thing about the Abood case. I thought that was decided law. And we had a chief justice who said he was gonna only call balls and strikes, and decided law was the law of the land. And yet here with this Janus case, we're going to upend decades of decided law. You look at Citizens United, you know, upended, you know, a couple of centuries of decided law. I fear that precedent doesn't seem to matter.
Well, I think that, you know, this is my subject area that I teach, so I believe that law is entirely wrapped up with politics. Sometimes that expresses itself in terms of partisan politics, but there's other kinds of politics that operate as well. So the Supreme Court is very jealous of the power of courts because that's the institution that it is. So it's jealous not just for its power, but also for the power of other courts. So you're right. There are different kinds of politics that are at play. And what we have seen, though, unveil over the last couple of decades has been this sort of renewed respect for state courts and their roles. So I'm going to be surprised if the Supreme Court really steps in, particularly if it steps in to say that the Pennsylvania court was wrong in interpreting the Pennsylvania Constitution.
Well, so we will certainly see how this plays out. But, you know, as I'm looking at it, there's an actual opportunity to have some reasonably competitive elections, which is all I really want. I don't want the maps gerrymandered to one side or the other. You know, I want actual competitive maps where people have the ability to go and cast their votes and have their votes actually count.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we should all want. We should want competitive districts where, in fact, people are able to express their opinions and have it make a difference. When districts are just constantly either purely Democrat or purely Republican, then we don't really have opportunities for any kind of change or for, as the mood changes, to make changes in government. So I think we should all want there to be as many competitive districts as we could possibly have.
And hopefully this map gets us closer to that and the Supreme Court stays out of it. Ken, I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing your thoughts. Look forward to talking to you again.
Great talking to you.
Good stuff. Ken Mash, president of AppScuff. You want to check out their website, appscuff.org is that site. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.